Good morning, early birds. You've caught the worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Coronavirus cases spike, a collapsed irrigation canal along Montana's High Line, and how educators have adapted during the pandemic. It's Thursday, June 25th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Governor Steve Bullock said yesterday, there's no doubt Montana has seen a spike in COVID-19 cases since the state moved into the second phase of its economic reopening plan in early June. Nearly a third of the state's 766 total known cases have been reported since June 1st. In a press conference outlining the state's efforts to trace known contacts of people tested positive for COVID-19, the governor said 136 people have tested positive for the disease over the past week. State officials say the increase in reported cases is tied to both economic reopening and more testing and tracing of known patients. They say Montana is close to reaching Bullock's stated goal of reaching 60,000 COVID-19 tests run in a month in Montana. Jim Murphy is the chief of the State Communicable Diseases Bureau.
I would hope that in the month of July, if the trends continue, we'll be meeting that 60,000 goal.
There are more than 170 people known to still be sick with a COVID-19 infection. Bighorn County has the highest count with 30. There are five other counties with double-digit active cases, including Gallatin, Yellowstone, Missoula, Rosebud, and Custer. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes plan to lift the shelter-in-place order on the Flathead Indian Reservation in mid-July. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the order was issued in late March when coronavirus cases were detected in the state.
The CSKT Tribal Council decided Tuesday that the shelter-in-place order on the reservation will be lifted July 13th, barring any new spikes in confirmed cases of COVID-19. Chairwoman Shelley Fiant says the council originally intended to lift the order June 29th, but held back because of a mass testing event on the reservation last week.
But we wanted to give it a week to get our test results back and also let the 4th of July holiday pass.
Fiant says tribal employees will return to their respective offices once the order is lifted. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Governor Steve Bullock says he will issue a directive today allowing visitors at assisted living facilities and nursing homes under strict guidelines. Bullock says the facilities will need to follow federal guidelines from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Moving forward, these facilities may allow visitors in accordance with CMS guidelines and after notifying both residents and family members.
Bullock says this decision was made with input from a group of healthcare providers, nurses, assisted living facility managers, and the state health department. A hiker received minor injuries from a grizzly bear Monday in Yellowstone National Park. Rachel Kramer reports.
A woman from Missouri was hiking alone on the Fairy Falls Trail near Old Faithful when she encountered two grizzly bears at close range. A press release from Yellowstone said the female bear knocked the woman to the ground while she attempted to use bear spray. The woman received a scratch on her thigh and minor injuries to her face, later declining medical attention. Bear management biologist Carrie Gunther said it appears to be, quote, a typical case of a mother grizzly bear protecting her offspring. He said no action will be taken against the bear. The trail and surrounding area has been temporarily closed. This is the first incident of a bear injuring a visitor in Yellowstone in 2020. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Montana wildlife officials announced Tuesday that they euthanized a young male grizzly bear near Shelby after repeated conflicts with humans. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks says the young male was involved in multiple conflicts, including getting into spilled grain and backyard grills. The bear also reportedly approached homes and people. Wildlife officials euthanized the bear last week. This is the 19th grizzly from the ecosystem surrounding Glacier National Park, known or thought to have died this year. Three cubs were also removed from the ecosystem and are now living in captivity, bringing total mortalities to 22. With about 5 months to go until bears den up, that number is likely to rise. Last year, 50 grizzlies were removed from the ecosystem, killed in a human-related incident, or were known to have died naturally. Last year followed 2018, when there were a record 52 mortalities. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
11 bull bison quarantined in a federal facility near Yellowstone National Park were transferred to the Fort Peck Indian Reservation yesterday. There, they'll complete the final phase of a program to make sure they are disease-free before being sent out to start or boost herds across the U.S. Rachel Kramer reports.
This is the fourth relocation of Yellowstone bison to the Fort Peck Indian Reservation since February 2019 under the current interagency quarantine program. The 11 bull bison transferred Wednesday will spend the next year in the tribe's quarantine facility, where they'll be tested every 6 months for brucellosis, a bacterial disease that can spread between bison, elk, and cattle if they come into contact with afterbirth tissues and fluids. The disease can cause infertility and miscarriages, which are financial threats to cattle ranchers. In 1995, the state of Montana sued the U.S. Park Service for allowing bison to leave Yellowstone and enter state land. An interagency team developed several management strategies to keep the herds from getting too large, including hunting bison that migrate out of the park and capturing them to ship to slaughter. The quarantine program provides an alternative ending for America's national mammal. The facility at Fort Peck increases the capacity to get more bison through the program. Bison that complete quarantine can be transferred to other tribes and conservation organizations to start or boost herds across the U.S. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
The U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee held its first hearing yesterday on the Montana Water Rights Protection Act, which would settle long-disputed water rights claims of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
The bill would prevent costly litigation over thousands of water rights claims filed by the tribes and would fund the rehabilitation of the Flathead Indian Irrigation Project. Montana Republican Senator Steve Daines spent much of his time during the hearing asking U.S. Department of Interior Assistant Secretary Tim Petty about whether the department supported the bill. Petty said the department supports the bill over costly litigation but did note some issues with oversight.
While the department has concerns with S-3019 as introduced, principally that the bill lacks necessary assurances that settlement funds will be spent and sent to sufficiently rehabilitate and modernize the system and project, we have worked diligently with the tribes to address these concerns.
Daines mentioned in the hearing that he plans to amend the bill to address the oversight concerns. Daines is sponsoring the legislation. Montana Democratic Senator John Tester is co-sponsoring it. Both Tester and Daines sit on the Indian Affairs Committee. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
The century-old St. Mary Canal has been a lifeline for communities along Montana's High Line. After a portion of it collapsed last month, agencies are scrambling to replace two key structures. Kay Erickson has the details.
The race is on to get water flowing again to the tribes, municipalities, and irrigators that depend on it. Crews started work Monday on Drop 5, the concrete structure that collapsed on May 17th, to determine the stability of the foundation under all the debris. Jennifer Patrick is the project manager for the Milk River Joint Board of Control, the group overseeing the construction.
There's a lot of material that's not there or has moved. Once you get in there, you get the structure, the hydraulics, everything worked out from what you have now. There's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of unknowns on manpower, hauling. Where are you bringing material from? Everything like that.
She says construction will begin on Drop 2, another at-rest structure, later this week. The price tag for both Drop 5 and Drop 2 is between $5 and $8 million. Still to be determined is how the cost share will be divided between the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, which owns the property and the system, and the water users, who usually foot most of the bill for maintenance and operation. If the Commissioner of Reclamation designates this a Public Law 11111 qualified emergency extraordinary maintenance, the federal share and the user's share climb closer to 50-50, and the locals can tap into bonding, grants, and loans from the state. Patrick says the goal is to have the construction completed and water flowing again in time to replenish reservoirs and other stored systems for next year. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kay Erickson.
A coal mining company that works in Montana filed a request in May for a judicial review of a recently changed rule for power plant air emissions standards. As Kayla DeRoche reports, a Montana environmental group filed a motion to intervene this past week.
Westmoreland Mining Holdings, which operates Rosebud Mine in Colstrip, Montana, filed a petition in Washington, D.C. federal court last month, asking for the review of the Environmental Protection Agency's mercury and air toxics standards. The court document does not explain the company's intentions, and Westmoreland declined YPR's request for a comment on the story. The lawsuit was filed on the same day the Environmental Protection Agency published a rule change that cut language saying it's, quote, appropriate and necessary, unquote, to regulate the emission of air toxins like mercury and arsenic from coal and oil-fired power plants. The EPA says that while emission standards remain in place, it made the change in language because it found the financial cost of the companies complying with the regulations outweighs the health benefits of the emissions reductions. The Montana Environmental Information Center joined around 20 other groups last week in filing a motion to intervene in Westmoreland's case on top of petitioning the EPA to review the rule change. Environmental law nonprofit Earth Justice represents a few of the advocacy groups listed on the case, including MEIC. Earth Justice attorney Neil Gormley says the new wording makes the mercury and air toxic standards vulnerable to legal challenge.
What matters is that the standards are now at risk. EPA has essentially invited the coal industry to go to court to take down the standards themselves.
YPR reached out to the EPA, which stated it does not comment on pending litigation. The mercury and air toxics standards apply to power plant emissions, including mercury, arsenic, and lead. Mercury exposure can lead to a number of health effects, including harm to the brain, heart, kidneys, lungs, and immune system. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
When the COVID-19 pandemic shut down in-person classes for K-12 schools across the state, teachers and staff scrambled to continue education remotely. The prognosis for their efforts isn't great. Researchers predict most students will see significant declines in math and reading skills due to their loss of in-person instruction. However, the shutdowns also prompted educators to develop new techniques they'll continue to use when they return to in-person classes. This story is part of a series about ways Montana found lasting adaptations during the shutdown. It's funded in part by the Solutions Journalism Network. Mary Old reports for Yellowstone Public Radio News.
In mid-March, students and teachers around the state left their classrooms for the weekend unaware that most wouldn't return until fall. When Linda Rost, Montana's 2020 Teacher of the Year, found out that she would have to finish the year remotely, she did something she'd never done. In a Zoom call, she asked her high school science students what they wanted to do. Rost teaches at Baker High School, which is in Fallon County on the North Dakota border. Her students came to an enthusiastic consensus. They wanted to do an open-ended research project on COVID-19.
One student looked at how we can implement social distancing in high school rodeos because she's a high school rodeo athlete. And another student was concerned because there were some ranchers who were talking about how they already vaccinate cattle for a coronavirus, so they weren't concerned about this virus. And so she wanted to investigate that virus and that vaccine.
Rost took another creative step. She asked her students to come up with ways to share their findings with the community. Some made PowerPoint presentations, others wrote letters for a time capsule, and a few created videos for the social networking platform TikTok. Senior Logan Graham recorded an interview for his project.
And today I'll be interviewing the mayor of Baker, Jody Pratt. I'll be asking her questions on how the COVID-19 and the recent quarantine has affected her job as mayor and her personal life.
Rost says giving students the opportunity to engage with the current event on their own terms was such a success that she'll offer more open-ended projects in the future.
The thing is, when you try new things in the classroom like this, and you give the students these opportunities to lead, you can really see how we've probably been doing it wrong for a long time by not giving them that opportunity.
While Ross' students finished out the year with remote learning, Circle Public School in Northeast Montana was one of the first schools in the country to reopen its doors. The Circle School Board oversees a rural district with fewer than 200 students in Macon County. As of June 16th, the county had no known cases of COVID-19. The board decided that with precautions, it would be safe for students to return. Superintendent Preston Wenz says the school closures made it clear that in addition to education, schools help meet basic needs, like food, social interaction, and mental health support.
It wasn't about making up for those academics that might have been lost from them being at home. It was all about the being able to close it out. And for the social and emotional side of it, to just know that they were able to come back to school.
Wen says his realization that students suffer without good counseling from the school will carry over into the fall. He plans to use CARES Act funds to bring in extra mental health support after summer vacation. The pandemic also revealed disparities in students' access to technology. Every teacher had to rely on the internet to keep in touch with students and families, give students assignments, and provide other kinds of support. Here's Wen's again.
You know, we're in such a technology age, it's easy to think, well, everybody's got internet, you know, one way or the other. And that's not true.
At the beginning of the school closure, teachers compiled a list of who could connect to the internet at home and who couldn't. Now they know and can plan to help students without reliable connections. And also, not every pandemic learning experience happened on computers. Wenz points to lessons that wouldn't have been possible during the traditional school day.
We're an agriculture, farming, ranching community, big time. And, you know, calving season was going on when this hit. And so we had a lot of kiddos out there pulling calves.
Students were excited about what they'd learned outside of academics.
These kids being able to work at home and work on the farm or even in town, going to their parents' business and whatnot, they were learning things that they'll never get out of a textbook.
Wen says he'll integrate more practical skills like hunting, fishing, and agriculture into the school day in the future. Like Wen's, educators across the state think that school will be different than it was before COVID-19. Montana's Office of Public Instruction created two task forces composed of teachers, students, and administrators. The groups will provide the state with recommendations for a post-pandemic education system. Some educators are optimistic the pandemic will give rise to a better public school system. Here's Teacher of the Year, Linda Rost, again.
And so I think this is our chance to rethink that and kind of reimagine what school can look like. And we are already doing innovative and creative things in our classrooms. And this is just a time when we're going to have to do that and probably just throw out a lot of the old ideas about what school looks like.
For Yellowstone Public Radio and the Solutions Journalism Network, I'm Mary Auld.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check out Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you, early birds, tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.